Noon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, March 8th. We have three public hearings and an informational meeting. I think we have adequate time to handle all of that today. Let's start with a roll call.
Representative Levy.
Here by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by video.
Representative Smith Warner.
Excused.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. Thank you. We have three public hearings. I'm going to ask that the speakers try to limit their comments to 3 minutes each. We hope that that would be enough time because I want to make sure we hear from all the speakers and have adequate time for the committee to ask questions. Also, would you please keep your camera off and your microphone off until you are called on to speak. We're going to take the bills in the order that they were printed on the agenda. At this time, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3295. Mr. Malik, would you please present the bill for us?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3295 changes the some of the conditions that you have today or currently on the distribution of the marijuana revenue to cities and counties. Marijuana revenue distribution, especially to cities and counties, went through a couple of permutations before they reached what we have today, which is a formula distribution based on two different conditions for each pot of money for either the cities or the counties. That was accomplished in House Bill 3470 of the 2017 session. However, the first condition of any of that is for the city or the county to be of the type that does not prohibit the establishment of marijuana businesses for the different kind of businesses that there are. This bill, House Bill 3295, changes that to basically make it not any businesses, but whether the prohibition includes all businesses. So in essence, it removes it from any business to all businesses. And that allows for some of the revenue to be distributed in a different way to counties and cities that otherwise, under the conditions today, would not have received it under the current law. In your SMS, I also put down the bill language refers to all license types by number of statute where that license type is. In the bottom of the SMS, I've put for you what those license types are by statutes. For example, 475B. .070 is a license, production license versus processor license, wholesale license, and retail licenses. These are the different licenses that that identify marijuana businesses that basically have the determination of whether cities and counties do have it. So that's, I think there is a real life situation, and I believe somehow have to work with probably Deschutes County and so on, and they would later on be presenting on this issue. That's what the bill does, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have any questions for Mr. Malik before we go to public testimony? I don't see any. We will now start our public testimony. First, I'd like to hear from Representative Zika, and after that will be Representative Kropp.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke. My name is Jack Zika, State Representative out of House District 53. Thank you for allowing me to testify on House Bill 3295. Since December of 2019, the Department of Revenue, OLCC, and DAS have not distributed Deschutes County's share of the Oregon marijuana account established to pursuant ORS 475B.759. Any other Oregon community will likely suffer the same fate if deciding to opt out of allowing any single class of marijuana business within that community, regardless of whether or not such marijuana business have already been legal, established, and regardless of other classes of marijuana business still being allowed to be established. House Bill 3295 clarifies that an Oregon county will automatically lose its entire share of Oregon marijuana account only if banning all classes of marijuana business. The current interpretation is that a county loses its entire share of the Oregon marijuana account if banning any single class of marijuana business. House Bill 3295 ensures that a community will not lose its entire share of Oregon marijuana account when only precluding the establishment of new marijuana businesses while allowing pre-existing and legally established marijuana businesses to continue. House Bill 3295 makes sense from a common sense perspective, and it ensures that Oregon communities continue receiving their share of the Oregon marijuana account, commensurate with their localized impacts and the taxes being generated locally. If an Oregon community decides to preclude the establishment of marijuana businesses or certain classes of marijuana businesses, then distribution formulas will already reduce that share of Oregon marijuana account distributed to those communities. There is no rational policy justification to punish a community by withholding the entire share of the Oregon marijuana account, especially when the same distribution formula precludes that share from being redistributed by any other Oregon county. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Kropp.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke and other members of the committee. I'm Jason Krupp, State Representative for House District 54, which includes most of Bend, the remainder of Bend not represented by Jack Zika. And thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of House Bill 3295. Measure 91 legalized marijuana here in Oregon. It also instituted its regulation and taxation of recreational cannabis. Contemplated in post that legalization statute, ORS 475B.759, created the initial allocation of that of the marijuana revenue generated from taxation of legalized marijuana. This bill in no way changes the formula or is another ask on that marijuana revenue that you've, I'm sure, heard previously and will continue to hear throughout the session. Currently, marijuana revenue for counties, there is a binary on-off switch whether a county gets an allocation of marijuana revenue. In order to qualify to get marijuana revenue, a county has to be a opt-in county that has to allow for the production or the processing, retail sale, and wholesale sale of marijuana within its county. And if it allows for opts into all four of those categories, it is allocated a share of the 10% of the Oregon marijuana account. That share is determined based on total number of licenses within a county and total number of acreages. And that makes sense. Your share of revenue goes up depending on how many businesses you have and how much acreages you use. So the lower amount of businesses and acreage, the lower your share, and the more businesses and acreage, the higher your share. And that approach made a lot of sense. That on-off switch made a lot of sense at the beginning of this legislation, when you had a choice as a county to either opt in or opt out into all four of those types of marijuana businesses. But that dynamic has changed, and now we have created a situation where counties that can have existing businesses are no longer able to receive a share of the marijuana revenue to address the impacts of legalized marijuana. And this is what has happened in Deschutes County. So Deschutes County in 2020 opted out of new production and processing permits only. We have existing marijuana businesses, and those businesses continue to operate. Businesses that had gained approval from the county prior to 2021 and were waiting OLCC approval are still able to seek OLCC approval and to begin operating in Deschutes County. And businesses still can seek retail and wholesale permits in the county. But because we've opted out of two of the four types of marijuana businesses under this binary on-off switch approach, we are no longer able to receive marijuana revenue. This also potentially has a negative impact on other counties that may choose to change or regulate the status of their opting in for different types of marijuana businesses. What this bill proposes is more of a sort of dimmer switch approach. Your allocation on a county level is directly related to how many existing businesses you have and how much existing acreage you have in marijuana business. If you have a small amount, you get a smaller share of the revenue to address the impacts. And if you have a larger amount, you get a larger amount of the revenue. We in Deschutes County previously had received a county allotment of that revenue, and we used that money to fund our county health department to address issues of substance abuse and law enforcement to address some of the impacts of marijuana legalization. What we're proposing is what I believe a simple fix to this bill. It takes into consideration the changing dynamics. It allows flexibility for a county to pursue the types of marijuana businesses it thinks is appropriate, and the number of businesses it seeks to be appropriate. And it gives an allotment based on existing marijuana businesses, not whether you have opted in or out of all four types of those types of marijuana businesses. Thank you for letting me testify on behalf of this bill. We do expect amendments to this bill to focus mainly on counties, and Department of Revenue and the county and OLCC is working on some amendments to make sure the intent of this bill is clear and can be clearly adhered to. Thank you for your time, and I will stick around for if there's any questions.
Thank you to both legislators who are with us. Committee members, do you have questions for these legislators? Representative Zika or Krupp? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be for either one of the representatives. And just, it sounded like this is something that Deschutes County ran into in 2019. And I'm just wondering if this bill is retroactive or it's just going to be going forward. These are the rules.
Thank you, Chair Reschke, and thank you, Chair Nathanson, or Vice Chair, excuse me. The intent of this bill is moving forward. So from this point forward, when the Department of Revenue looks at allocations, it does so based on a formula that's based on existing businesses. And so if this, you know, right now it pertains only to Deschutes County, there's potential it could pertain to other counties moving forward, but it would be forward looking and it would not be a retroactive ask for revenue.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Croft, and Madam Chair, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for being with us. Next, we'll hear from Rob Bovet, and after that will be Tony DeBone.
Great. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel and legislative director for the Association of Oregon Counties. I think the representatives did a pretty good job of it. I won't speak to the language of the bill, but maybe if I could just back up a little bit and kind of explain how we made this error. I think it's an error. And this is really all around production, by the way. This is what it's about. So back in 2015, when we were rewriting Measure 91, we had to kind of figure out this tax disentitlement entitlement thing. And to be honest, we kind of punted. So I wrote a switch, and I'm sorry, I wrote a switch and not a dimmer switch. I didn't think about this, to be honest, and I think it's just because we were moving too fast. So what this really amounts to, and for example, the state has also shut off new licensees for production. And we're not suggesting the state disentitle itself from everything, right? I mean, so this is a waxing and waning of production. And Deschutes County has particular challenges around land use, and this is not anybody's fault, but back in the 70s, they put most of what we would consider today rural residential into resource lands, which is different. And so it's created lots of land use tensions in Deschutes County around cannabis production. There's plenty of cannabis production there today, but voters in Deschutes County said, hold up, pause here. We got enough going on right now. And to me, it just seems kind of fundamentally unfair that we say, okay, since Deschutes County voters said no more of the production side right now, that we essentially disentitled Deschutes County, the government, from all of the marijuana revenues. And by the way, those marijuana revenues just took a 72% hit out of the gate to begin with. So to me, I think we ought to fix that. I don't necessarily like the language in the bill, and I know the representative referenced some amendments. I think we can do a clean surgical fix here to make sure that Deschutes County is treated fairly. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, but I think that's the core of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Beauvais. Tony DeBone.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke and members of the Committee on House on Revenue. I am here to support a version of the bill that supports the distribution of marijuana tax to
our counties. Excuse me, just for the purpose of the recording, would you please state your name for the record?
Yep. Yeah, Tony DeBone, current Deschutes County Commissioner. I am here in support of a bill that will provide that historical distribution that has been in place previously. There's a history of opting out and opting in our county. Measure 91 was passed, land use and resource lands became the issue. We opted out so we could put in reasonable regulations, and we filled the room every time we had a hearing on this. We put regulations in place, we proceeded, we approved some, we denied some applications. And then a year later, we also reviewed the regulations that were in place. And then it ended up just being kind of a dead end. And we said, we need guidance from the voters. So then we opted back out to put this to a vote of the people. Just this last year, the vote was 57% to uphold the opt-out. So we're done with negotiating, but we do have approved businesses. And we also have approved pending businesses, so there's even more production businesses that could come online here in Deschutes County. We also have processors and the potential for more processing from previous approved applications. So we just happen to be in that spot where we opted out, opted in, opted out, and then the voters opted out officially. It obviously has not been contemplated. We are participating. We've kind of landed where we're going to be in Deschutes County with our land use around these applications. And we really would like to come up with a bill that provides clarity on the distribution of the taxes. No change to the system, just the current taxes. Thank you very much for letting me testify on this matter. It does sound like there may be some proposed edits. We are working with the state agencies on this also at this time. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. Committee, do you have questions for these speakers? Yes, Representative Marsh. Representative Marsh, we're not hearing you right now.
Thank you. I do have a question for the County Commissioner DeBono. Thank you for being here. When the voters were given the choice of opting in or opting out, did they understand that there were tax implications, revenue implications there?
I don't think that was the domain of the vote. It was very much the rural county. Remember, so the city of Bend is half the population, and the city of Bend is not even in this situation. So it's just the rural property owners that got involved in this. But it was a vote by everybody in the county. But the topic was not tax revenue for the vote.
But that was an implication of the vote.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh, do you have a follow-up?
I don't, thank you.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also had a follow-up to that. Just, can you give me a sense of how, what kinds of numbers we're talking about? This is just for my own education, in terms of to Deschutes County, what is the impact? What's the average annual disbursement from the marijuana account?
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I think we're talking about $500,000 annually is kind of a number that we've worked with. And it's, as I say, it's kind of scheduled to go up because there's other approvals pending.
Thank you.
And Chair Nathanson, this is Rob Ovette, if I could add again.
Sure.
That's a good number, but you have to subtract 72% of that, because 72% of that will go to measure 110.
Oh. Wow.
Which is another issue that it's not clear whether voters understood what they were, what the impact of their vote would be. I am hearing something from someone who is not speaking right now. Could you please mute your microphone? Someone who is not a current witness. Thank you. Committee, any other questions for any of these speakers on House Bill 3295? Thank you all for being with us today. Manny, has anyone else signed up to speak for 3295 since I printed my list?
No, Madam Chair.
That completes the speakers for House Bill 3295. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3295. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3138. Mr. Alanak, is that you?
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So House Bill 3138 relates to the estate tax. The bill would extend the filing deadline from 9 months to 12 months after the date of death. And this would apply to the estates of decedents dying on or after January 1, 2022. This bill may seem familiar. It had made it out of the House Revenue Committee and over to the Senate back in 2019. And then it kind of got sidelined in that session.
Thank you. We have two people signed up to testify. Representative Noble, are you with us?
I am, Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Ron Noble. I'm the state representative for House District 24, and I'm here today to express my support and illustrate the need for House Bill 3138. A constituent approached me a couple years ago regarding a lengthy and problematic probate process following a death in the family where a will was not present. Between grieving for the loss of a loved one and struggling to obtain the required documentation to begin and complete the probate process, my constituent found herself unable to file and pay estate taxes on time. This was not for any lack of effort on her part, and House Bill 3138 will give people like her the necessary time to complete the probate process in order to file and submit their estate taxes. Currently, if no federal return is required, a return must be filed with the Department of Revenue within 9 months following the date of death. If a federal return is required, the state tax must be filed and paid at the same time the federal tax is due. This bill would remove the discrepancies between these two filing deadlines, create one deadline for filers that is extended to 12 months following the date of the death. The probate process can present a plethora of problems to grieving families that are often understandably inexperienced in handling these affairs. Additionally, other barriers to filing may arise that are completely out of the control of the family, creating a situation where the taxes cannot be paid within the current allotted timeframe. The underlying bill extends the deadline, while the amendment is the result, was an amendment back in 2019 by the Department of Revenue, the result of the work in standardizing filing deadlines for all filers. While we may not be able to prevent unforeseen circumstances that prevent timely completion of the probate process, we can ensure that grieving families have adequate time to get their estate tax liabilities in order. As was mentioned, in 2019, this bill passed the House Revenue Committee and the floor of the House unanimously and installed in the Senate towards the end of that session. I thank you for your time and consideration and urge an aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Noble. Committee, any questions for Representative Noble in case he needs to leave to go to another meeting? I don't see any right now. Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Linda O'Hara.
Chair Nathanson, I think I saw Vice Chair Reschke had his hand up briefly.
Oh, I don't see it right now. I'm so sorry. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Pham. Representative Noble, do you recall the bill number from 2019 offhand? If not, that's not a problem. I'm just wondering if you had it for my notes.
Yes, I do. It's in 2019, it was bill number 3197.
And, 3197. Okay.
Yeah, A. Engrossed.
Thank you.
Well, that's what I call being punctilious. Linda O'Hara, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this. I am the constituent that Representative Noble talked about. Almost 6 years ago, I lost one of my sisters, and that's why I'm here today to talk to you about the challenges that we face, we being my family. Unfortunately, my sister died with assets and no will. Getting a personal representative approved by the courts in a timely manner was a problem. We faced challenges acquiring necessary documents and information from some of the organizations that my sister had her assets with. And unfortunately, advice from professionals was not always accurate 6 years ago. However, what I'm asking for you from you is to fix what you do have in your control, as Representative Noble spoke so eloquently about, and that is to extend the deadline related to tax filings for liabilities owed from 9 months to 12 months. And I can't express enough how much of a difference just three more months would have made 6 years ago had we had that time to do what we needed to do on behalf of the estate. I thank you for your time and opportunity to talk about this.
Thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it. Committee members, do you have questions for Ms. O'Hara? I don't see any right now. Thank you again for being with us.
I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope you can see this through. As Representative Noble said, it made it through the House, but delays 2 years ago in the Senate, it died. So here we are again. So I appreciate your support.
I'm glad we're hearing the bill again today.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Manny, did anyone else sign up for this bill?
No, Madam Chair.
There are no other witnesses to testify on 3138. Committee members, any final questions or thoughts before we close this public hearing? I'm closing the Public hearing on House Bill 3138. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2294. This is a bill that we were hearing last week. We did not have adequate time to hear from all of the witnesses who had signed up. Since that time, Legislative Revenue Office has contacted anyone who was not able to testify to ask if they were still interested in testifying, and we have a new list of witnesses for today. LRO, is there anything you would like to say to briefly start this hearing for us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you mentioned, this is the bill that you were hearing on Thursday, last Thursday, the 8th, and this is the bill that looks into imposing a wholesale tax based on the change of location of the product from one county to the other, and having this to be a county benefit tax, kind of on the wholesale of the marijuana.
Thank you. Committee, any questions before we go to the witnesses? First, I'd like to hear from Casey Houlihan. After that, it will be Megan Wallstatter and Kim London.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Casey Houlihan. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We're the largest trade association of cannabis businesses in the state, with over 500 member businesses located all across the state and businesses of all sizes. We're here today to express our strong opposition to House Bill 2294. I want to start by saying that I very much appreciated the comments from Representative Morgan and Representative Brock Smith about how this idea is not quite ready for prime time and does involve further development and would likely be worth revisiting in future sessions. But House Bill 2294 seeks to add an additional layer of taxation on our nascent industry at the wholesale level. However, doing so would create several unintended consequences, many of which were carefully considered by your colleagues and predecessors in the legislature during the implementation of Measure 91 in 2015, at which time it was decided for many reasons that a single layer of taxation at the retail level was the most sensible and least burdensome method of applying taxes. This was the determination made after carefully studying the multi-layered tax structure implemented by our neighbors in the state of Washington and learning from some of their early mistakes. The current system of a single point of sale retail tax reduces the overall burden on cannabis businesses upstream in the supply chain from having to interface with the Department of Revenue, which in an industry that is already forced to operate predominantly, if not entirely, in cash, can be costly and burdensome and often requires employees from businesses operating in disparate parts of the state to drive great distances with large amounts of cash in order to make regular tax payments. The bill would also create a patchwork system that would result in some producers and wholesalers being taxed somewhat capriciously simply for selling their products into markets outside of their county of origin, while others, including those in the Portland and Eugene metro areas, the largest consumer markets in the state, would not be required to pay this wholesale tax. The net result of this patchwork would actually be a market disadvantage to producers and processors and wholesalers operating in the rural areas of the state with the highest production outputs. Further, the increased costs from this additional layer of taxation are most likely to be passed along to consumers, which will drive up prices and decrease profits for already stressed businesses and displace even more consumers from the already fragile legal market, given the ready availability of illicit market cannabis here in the state. It is for these reasons that we strongly oppose House Bill 2294. Thank you for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Houlihan. Can you stay with us for a minute while we hear from the other speakers before I ask for questions?
Happily. Thank you.
Megan Wallstatter.
Hi. Hi, Chair Nathanson and members of the House Committee on Revenue. My name is Megan Wallstatter, and my husband and I own a Tier 1 production license in Clackamas County. I'm a founding member of the Oregon Cannabis Association. Currently, I'm also a board member and chair of the Ledge Policy Committee. I urge you to oppose House Bill 2294. I appreciate Rep. Morgan's testimony and support Casey Houlihan's testimony. The cannabis industry operates with lower margins than any other business due to Section 280E of the Internal Revenue Code. We aren't able to deduct traditional business costs such as payroll, rent, supplies, etc. In addition to our Tier 1 production license, my husband and I used to own Pure Green, a retail store in Portland. Due to Section 280E, we had a huge tax bill that led to a federal tax payment plan that lasted several years. The Oregon Department of Revenue audited all of our 2015 tax returns. This also resulted in a large state tax bill that required a payment plan. After the audit, we could no longer afford to run the store. We sold Pure Green to a Canadian company that closed the store when the pandemic first hit. Pure Green remains closed. We would have been forced to sell our store sooner or close it ourselves if there was a wholesale tax that could have been passed through to the retailer or consumer. Over the last year, cannabis businesses were excluded from federal pandemic and wildfire relief money, compounding the complexities and increased business costs arising from the impacts of 280E. Cannabis businesses have limited access to outside financial support, a wholesale tax which shake the already struggling industry and force closures of all license holders. House Bill 2294 would be a discriminatory tax for all producers, wholesalers, and processors outside of Multnomah County. One third of all retail stores are located within Multnomah County. As a result, license holders in Multnomah County who sell to Multnomah County retailers would be exempt from this tax. With fewer retail outlets in their counties, rural growers, processors, and wholesalers would carry the burden of this tax. This would include the counties deeply affected by the wildfires. Cannabis consumers are very frugal and hyper-focused on prices due to the highly competitive nature of both the regulated and unregulated markets. When we owned Pure Green, our best-selling product was a particular strain grown by a particular farm. When another store started carrying this product at a lower price, our customers flocked to the other store until we lowered our price to match them. The management staff at Pure Green were constantly researching prices to remain competitive. This intense price sensitivity market makes our industry especially vulnerable to any tax increase, which will need to be passed on to consumers since retail margins are so slim. In such a price-sensitive industry, an added tax will drive people from the legal market back to the illicit market, where the product is untested, dealers don't check IDs, and the sales don't generate tax dollars for the state of Oregon. In 2015, when Oregon was examining a tax at the wholesale level, the legislators chose to not implement a wholesale tax in order to attract growers and processors from the medical and unregulated market. Our neighbor, California, has had a rocky transition to the regulated market because of their taxation at the wholesale and retail level. For these reasons, I urge you to please oppose House Bill 2294.
Thank you for the testimony, and can you stay with us for just a few minutes? Thank you.
Sure, of course.
Kim London?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kim London. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cannabis Association. We are a member-driven association representing cannabis businesses and their allied businesses around the state. I'd also like to thank Rep. Morgan for her testimony last week and for acknowledging that this bill is not the best mechanism for new taxation. I'd like to share my support for her district and all of our Southern Oregon community, which is home of some of the best sun-grown cannabis in the country and our most treasured family farms. I, too, today am speaking against House Bill 2294 and, in general, against any new taxes on the Oregon's cannabis industry. Under a new administration and rising support across the country, there has been much talk around federal legalization and the opportunities that that will bring to Oregon as a producer state. There's a saying in our industry that if you can make it in Oregon, you can make it anywhere. And this comes from the fact that our cannabis businesses are the best of the best. And the feeling is that if you can compete here, you can compete anywhere. Our businesses are run by creative, industrious Oregonians who have an obsessive passion for producing quality products. These innovative small businesses will drive Oregon to be a national leader once federal prohibition on cannabis is ended. But we will only be able to take advantage of these opportunities for small business development, job creation, tourism, and tax revenue if we have a healthy, diverse cannabis industry alive and thriving when that happens. Sales numbers in the industry can be misleading because they don't reflect the higher tax rates and business expenses due to operating state legal businesses under federal prohibition. Oregon cannabis businesses are operating without any of the protections that other businesses have relied on to get them through the crises of the last year. They did not have small business relief loans or paycheck protection programs for when their employees got sick or were exposed to the virus. And because of banking laws, they don't have access to traditional financing, which means they can't even get a business credit card to get them through a hard month. Our folks have made it through one of the hardest years on record, and they've done it on their own. They're hanging on, but just barely. This is a crucial time for our industry, and imposing taxes now will have devastating effects. Not only will we be hurting small businesses, but we'll be jeopardizing the potential of Oregon's cannabis market for years to come. I encourage you all today and throughout the legislative session to consider supporting Oregon's cannabis industry as a long-term investment in Oregon's future. Thank you very much.
And thank you as well for the testimony. Committee members, do you have questions for any of these speakers? I'm not seeing any. Okay, thank you very much. Manny, did we have any others sign up since the time I printed my witness registration?
No, Madam Chair.
Committee members, any final questions or comments before I close this public hearing? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2294. I'm opening an informational meeting. This is to continue our discussion on property tax. Mr. Alanak.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So as the chair indicated, this is just to keep the discussion moving on property tax reform. There is a small slide deck in OLIS that I was going to walk through. So I'll go ahead and share my screen. And this is just building on the conversation that the committee has been engaged in off and on throughout the session. Most recently, there was a public hearing on HJR 13, and I think that was 2 weeks ago. And so basically, I was taking notes during that discussion and have synthesized some of the information here and tried to provide a recap of a couple things, as well as touch on a couple of other items to move the discussion forward and give the committee some things to think about to encourage some additional committee discussion. So this first slide is just basically notes that I took from the last meeting. And depending on, you had a lot of good testimony from the public and various stakeholders, and some of the items might have raised some questions. One of them was the idea of whether or not the property tax is regressive or is it a wealth tax. It was described as both, and those may seem incongruent. But generally, it's kind of a little bit of both, because the tax is not a function of income. And two people who live in the same house with the same assessed value and pay the same tax could have different levels of income. And so in that sense, it can be regressive. It can also be considered a wealth tax because it is does increase generally with the value of a home in a broad sense. There were some discussions of incremental reform or wholesale reform. As the committee is aware, most of the changes that can be made have to be done through a vote of the people. It's a constitutional change. There was some discussion, at least in the HJR 13, it suggested one change that was a starting point for some discussion, which was to set the CPR to all property to 0.75, and it had this 5-year phase-in period. And so that would be something to consider rather than an abrupt change. And I put the M50 lessons here. One aspect of Measure 50 was that when it was implemented, it was voted on Measure 47 by voters in 96 and the Measure 50 in 97. And it set assessed values at 90% of the real market value back in 95, 96. So there were cases due to the functioning of assessment offices in the counties where they had found a mistake on the rolls in 95, 96. They corrected that in 96, 97, but then with Measure 50, reverted back to the error that was on the rolls because there wasn't a way to correct that mechanism. So that built in some inequities within the system just by the mechanics of moving to that policy. So those would be, that's an example of some of the things that you would likely want to consider. Another issue that is was raised and is always raised with property taxes, uniformity throughout the state versus local choices and local control. And so that would be something to consider on exactly where that balancing point is, where is that sweet spot, so to speak, between the two. One testifier mentioned an interim task force, which does have the value of giving enough time to get into the complexities of the property tax system, as well as all of the policy implications. And that's where it's probably wise to tread carefully on changes that get made and understanding all of the nuances of the current system and what changes might mean to future changes to the system. And one item I listed there was property classes. I'll come back to that. I have a slide later on the property classes. There was also the role of local fees. That's an area where local governments have been able to change some of their policies. And that might be for consideration if you're going to change, if you're going down the path of considering wholesale changes to the property tax system, you know, what about local fees, whether or not they should be changed. And then the last bullet point, Measure 5 and compression. Most of the discussion revolves around addressing Measure 50 and the permanent rates and so forth. But Measure 5 and compression can also be a significant limiting factor that we don't want to lose sight of.
Committee, before we move to the next slide, do you have any questions or comments on the points that have just been made? This review of issues raised during testimony. I have one. Mr. Allenek, there are fees for all sorts of things in state and local governments, many, many different types of fees, but there are probably some specific types of fees that are associated with this discussion and property taxation. Could you say just a little bit more about the kind of fees that might come into play in this aspect? And then after that, we will go to Representative Reschke.
Madam Chair, the fees that I had generally in mind were those imposed by counties and maybe cities. I'm trying to recall specific ones. Over the years, I've been a part of a variety of groups or task forces looking at this, and we've heard, groups have always heard, have often heard from local officials about how their hands are tied with the property tax system, but there still is a need for additional revenue to respond to increased demand for services. And where they've been able to respond to that is to increase fees. And as we've discussed throughout the session, the impact of the fees, in some sense, bears the value of fees coincide with this benefits principle. If I'm a citizen and I'm going to take advantage of something and I have to pay a fee for it, then that aligns with this benefits principle. But if those fees are increasing because that's the only mechanism by which local governments can meet the demands for budgetary purposes, that starts to get out of alignment. And so that's why it's important to keep that in mind, just how all of those issues might line together, the imposition of changes in fees, as well as the overall, because the baseline structure for financing local government is the broad property tax.
when I think of fees that are more closely related to development of property or land use or building and so forth, one of the ones that we hear about sometimes is SDC, system development charges. But I assume that those are the ones that are most likely to be discussed or to be raised in a conversation that has to do with because they're most closely related to property, either the development or improvement of real property. Is that what you're thinking about?
That's a large one. The specific example that comes to mind, and I just remember, I believe it was a county commissioner, it had to do with either a fee for a septic system or a well in a rural county, in a rural part of a county. I mean, I specifically remember that one, but the SDCs are a very broad one, and there's a lot that gets tied up into those as well.
Thank you. We're going to hear from Representative Reschke, and then after that will be Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. The property tax is pretty complex, and I know Representative Nose brought HJR 13 for us that kind of puts everybody exactly the same, but that's going to create a lot of losers and probably some winners, and I don't think we know right now what kind of repercussions that's going to have in our districts and different parts of our district. So I'm more of a fan of taking those complexities and the policy decisions and looking at it in the interim to make sure we give enough flexibility for Multnomah County versus Klamath County, for example. And Multnomah County in itself is pretty complex just by itself. I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I am wondering how broad we want this issues for consideration list to be, because there are additional items that I would place on this list if the intent is to try to get a broad listing of the problems that we run into when we look at the property tax.
This is time for an open conversation among the committee members. I think anything you'd like to raise that's relevant to this is fine.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I have been thinking for a while that we really need to look at the way that the property tax is still used to fund schools. A good chunk of the local property tax goes into the big school funding bucket. It's not controlled by local communities. It's not really relevant to local communities. It's just collected through the property tax, and it's not supportive directly of local governments. And I think that's a question that should be on the table if we start looking at how to significantly change the structure of the property tax.
Thank you for the comment. Committee, anything else before we move to the next slide? Let's go on.
Sorry about that. There's a delay in the tech here. So this slide shows a graph that is put out. I think it's in the Department of Revenue property tax statistics book. And it shows the history of real market value and assessed value going back to the early 1990s. And one of the comments that was made, or a couple of the comments that were made last time, was that they noted that voters passed these and they opted for predictability, which voters did. And the system is predictable from an assessed value perspective in that it can grow by 3% per year. Prior to this, one of the concerns about the property tax, and this is just in general about property taxes, is the ability to pay these and the fact that it's not tied to income. It's the other side of the stability piece of that tax. And there can be a period where if value is growing rapidly, that the tax can increase rapidly. And that's what the chart here shows in general. And it's a chart for the entire state, where the blue line here is the real market value. We see the run up in the odd years, and then the Great Recession, and then climbing back. And the dashed red line is the assessed value. So this could also be viewed as a as an example. If you picture this being a particular property, a home, where their assessed value just kind of chugs forward at 3% per year, and that gives that stability from the individual taxpayer's perspective. Whereas if the tax base were, again, a fixed rate system, not a levy-based system, because that has other self-correcting pieces in it, but a rate-based system that is tied to the value, then you can have periods where the tax can increase dramatically here and then decrease, and that's a volatility, and that's part of what taxpayers were presumably voting against. Now, keeping in mind the time period when this passed, Measure 5 had been passed in 1990, and the first half of the 90s, we saw the phase-in of those rates. So there are a period of 5 years where property taxes might have even been declining on a year-over-year basis for property owners. And then the first year, 96, 97, after the Measure 5 rates, compression rates had been phased in fully, property taxes took a big increase in 96, 97. And then a month later, taxpayers get to vote on what was Measure 47. And so predictability was raised a couple of weeks ago, and I think that's an important factor to keep in mind. But on the other hand, you have at what price does predictability occur? And I'm opposing these kind of proposing these as questions or just carrying this forward, is the equity that we've talked about a little bit across property owners in a given neighborhood or even across the state, exactly what does equity mean? And the ability to pay is also key. That was raised a couple weeks ago about whether or not HJR 13 would address the ability to pay. And the measure itself doesn't. It was just one idea around viewing equity through the specific lens of the AV to RMV ratio. And the fairness is the regional piece. And that was raised, I think, just a few minutes ago, that different counties have different local needs, and what might be fair in one county might not be fair in another county, or might not be as much of an issue. And then I also want to mention administration. That's always key here. Prior to Measure 50, I believe the counties dealt with appeals a great deal when the tax was based on real market value. And so the appeals function and the activity around appeals is a lot less these days. But another important consideration is the assessment function. If county assessors are not having enough funding to deal with property assessment, that is another way that inequities can leak into the system, if you will. And so that's kind of a funding mechanism that comes into play. And you've heard a couple of bills on that issue. So then going to the next slide, I'm pausing to see if there are any questions. Okay. So one area where we haven't talked too much about the notion of equity is across property classes. And this is a slide that Jamie included in her orientation. And it provides the property assessed value and the tax imposed by class. So you can see here where residential property is about 52% of the assessed value, but might pay 55% of the tax. And then so forth for commercial and industry, multi-housing, and so forth. And one expectation might be that these bars should be the same size, the blue and the green bars. But one thing to keep in mind here about why they might be different, there are at least three reasons. You can have property tax exemptions that can be affecting commercial and industry property more than residential property. You have business properties depreciable, so that's going to be on the roll at a higher CPR. And then you also have tax code areas where residential properties, for example, are obviously going to exist in cities, and farm and forest, for example, will not be existing in cities. So this is an example, just in part getting at some of the complexity in the system where you have information and it takes a little time to think about what that information conveys or doesn't convey as you're going through this. So the next slide here is, it's a repeat of one that you've seen before, and this is a residential property for fiscal year 1920. And we have this only for 30 counties, but this is one that we've talked about a little bit. It can be a bit thick. It's a statistical table that really gets at this AV to RMV ratio. And building on a comment that Rep. Reschke made a little bit ago, the HJR 13 would put everybody at this 0.75. It would basically take all of these boxes and then put them on a straight line at 0.75. So holding everything else equal, all the properties that are above that would see a tax decrease, and all of the properties below it would see a tax increase. I'm making some simplifying assumptions there, but that's the theme there. And to really think about what those implications are would be important, and you can see how it would vary where, for example, in County 13, which is Harney County, maybe that means a tax cut for most taxpayers. And in Multnomah County, probably a tax increase for most taxpayers. And that really gets at the wisdom, if you will, of whether or not 0.75 for the entire state across all property classes is really the way to go. And part of the reason I included this chart is I've also included the similar chart for commercial and an industrial property. So it's the same type of information where the box here, you had, well, I guess going back to the beginning of this, the top here is the maximum. We've looked at the roll data, individual property level data. And we have the maximum ratio is this top bar. The minimum ratio is the bottom bar. The mean is the diamond, and the median is the solid line. So the solid line means half the properties are above that, and then half are below it. And then the box here is the interquartile range, where this is the 75th percentile, and that's the 25th percentile. But just comparing residential property to commercial and industrial property, you can see how much broader these boxes are for business property and how much closer to one these properties are compared to residential property.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chris, thank you for these other slices that we can look at as far as, you know, by industry or by type, I guess. I'm just thinking if we went to from 0.75 to 0.25, then everybody wins, except for we might get a few calls from county commissioners, I might suspect. But not joking, but being serious, again, I think we really have to be careful what we do here, because we are playing around with a lot of dollars that isn't state revenue per se, but ends up going to the counties. And with a bill in the past on property tax exemptions, that caused a lot of consternation and took a couple of years to unwind. So again, I'm just gonna point back to this idea of a work group or a task force that can kind of dig into these issues and play scenarios and see how they all come out, rather than trying to rush through something here in the 21 session. Thank you.
Representative Marsh, did I see your hand go up? Yes, Representative Marsh.
Okay, I think I finally got my mute to stay off for a few minutes. Can I assume in looking at these two charts that one of the takeaways is there's been much less appreciation in commercial property than in residential over this period of time?
Generally speaking, the commercial and industrial property is depreciable. And so the value depreciates over time. So it's not, so you are correct. It's not going to appreciate like the residential property. And if we bounce back and going the wrong way. If we go back to this chart, and if we view this as a single property, you can see how the ratio would change over time. It would simply be the value of this red line divided by the blue line. And here, maybe that ratio is fairly fixed. Here, that ratio is rapidly declining, and then it would start to increase again, and then it would decline. And what we've had in some other charts are these scatter plot charts that show how this ratio changes over time. And the inequities, if you will, really happen when for properties, neighborhoods, or areas that have the fast growing value. And then that sets in into the system, the CPR that is fixed, so that when new property comes online, it's already built into that lower ratio, which further exacerbates the problem.
Do you have a follow-up, Rep. Marsh?
No, thank you. That was great.
Mr. Alanak, I would like to follow up then on the points that were just made about depreciation versus appreciation. There, I'm now very interested in understanding a little bit better the points. There's the value of the land, and then the value of the improvement on the land. Commercial properties and industrial properties are different sorts of improvements than residential. Residential, you have single family homes, duplexes, multifamily of different types. It could be sort of like row houses or condos. It could be apartment buildings, but then over a certain size, that becomes commercial property, I assume, not residential. Is that, I don't know what the cutoff is there. But the concept of appreciation and depreciation, I think, is pretty interesting, especially when we hear issues related to whether property owners are or are not interested in maintaining a home, let's say. So renters might be living in a decreasingly comfortable or safe home or neighborhood because the property owner wasn't motivated to invest in it because of the way the value is accrued on residential. So what else, do we have any resources that explain a little more generally how the concepts of depreciation or appreciation play out in our kind of tax system?
Well, for it is important to keep in mind land versus the improvements. Now, the categories that are in this commercial industry are improved properties. So it's all wrapped up into that one value. And it's just another factor for thinking across the property classes. I mean, when ostensibly, it certainly looks like when Measure 47, the precursor to 50, was put together, it was drafted from the perspective of a homeowner and wanting predictability so that the value grew 3% over time. And it didn't seem to take into account all of the other kinds of property and how those patterns might differ over time. With the business property and the depreciable property being the biggest key. One thing that has been discussed, some stakeholders have suggested, is having a split role, that property taxes for residential property be treated one way and business property be treated another way. And there can be pros and cons to that approach. For anybody who's in favor of that, you can probably find somebody who opposes the complexity that adds to it. It's just another factor that we want to be aware of when even thinking about what changes should be made.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, you have another point?
I'm sorry, no, I don't. Thank you.
Looks like we're ready to move to the next slide.
Okay, this slide, we've only talked a little bit about the capitalization of the tax savings that get the tax saving, how tax savings get capitalized into the value of property. And so this chart might redefine oversimplification, but I'm trying to get at a particular point here where we have two properties. We can call these neighbors, and they're each paying $1,000. So these are residential properties. And oftentimes, and this is very much a residential perspective, where somebody's looking to buy a home and they can afford $1,000 a month. And the three big pieces for that payment will be the principal and interest on the loan, and then the property tax. So if you have neighbors here and you've heard examples of the tale of two houses, tale of two businesses, where the value is the same and dramatically different property taxes. So this is kind of born from that, but much less decorative. So you have the $1,000 that's being paid, and property A is able to put down, they're able to pay $500 a month toward the principal, and they're paying $400 a month in taxes. Property B, however, is only paying $200 a month in property taxes and can put for more money, $700, into the property. And that's an example of what we mean by the capitalization. They're able to put more money into the value of their home. So they, over time, are creating more wealth for themselves because they're owning more of their home over time, whereas property A is spending more of their $1,000 budget on the services. So the inequity is kind of in two pieces. One, these are neighbors. They're paying for the same local services, the same city, same schools, and so forth, but one is paying twice as much as the other for those services. So that's one aspect of the inequity, which has been presented before. But the other piece is the amount that they're able to put into their home and to buy down to gain equity in their home. And that can actually, and that's kind of what the bar charts here try to highlight. And what that can really factor into is the ability to pay more for a home if the property taxes are less. Because even after, so, and what I mean by that, the $1,000 you can put forth on a month, if that's your monthly budget, then the amount of home you can buy can be more when the taxes are lower, and that can help drive up the prices of homes in those areas when the taxes are less. And this is some of what we've seen exemplified, I think, in the Multnomah County area. And the other piece of it is that the property taxes don't go away. Even when you own your home, the property taxes will still be there. So property A continues to pay more for the same services that property B does. So some of the information, the capitalization piece, we've included links to reports on that can be kind of dense in terms of it from an academic standpoint. This is just really trying to get about as simplified as possible to highlight that issue.
Any questions on this slide before we go to the next one? I do have one point. Mr. Alanak, listening to you describe this, tell me if this takeaway is mistaken. We generally think of taxes being reactive to the price or the value, but what we just heard is there is a relationship that results in taxes actually driving pricing.
Yes, I think that's a factor in that, and you see that in some neighborhoods. Neighborhoods can change over time, but to the extent that a given area, low taxes are locked in because they're tied to that AV, which is no bearing on RMV, that can make a neighborhood, that can be a factor in making a neighborhood more desirable, and it starts to build on itself. Which is why some of the inequities that were expected to be the result of Measure 50 have been talked about for, well, since Measure 50 came into existence.
Thank you.
The last or second to last slide I have here is kind of continuing on that idea of a task force. In 2008, the legislature did establish one, and it was the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring. And the focus of this particular group, which was staffed by LRO, was on broad structural tax reform for the state. So a lot of it focused on the income tax. But I did pull three bullet points in their findings section related to the property tax system. And so this is a report that the task force met through the throughout 2008, and the report was released in early 2009. And so I've just highlighted a couple pieces here. The first bullet point stating where the task force found that Measure 50 creates inequities in the property tax system and linked it to high growth in the inequity was focused on homeowners in high growth real estate markets compared to those with low growth. And that's where we've seen that over time. You've seen that a few different ways presented to you. The second bullet point just highlights the limitations of these permanent rates and the inability to change them without changing the Constitution. And it makes it difficult for local governments to respond to other broad changes. And the example that they focused at the time was the phase out of the federal timber payments to those counties who received that money. And the third bullet point was related to inflation. Throughout 2008, there was still a lot of concern about inflation being above the 3% growth, and that if we hit 5% inflation, which didn't seem that outrageous, that could put locals in a very tight bind with the AV growth limited to 3%. Given everything that's happened over the past 10 years and where we've been in the past few years, it seems a little strange to talk about interest rates being at 5%. They've been so low for so long, but that still does remain a risk. Just moving forward, it would be helpful, I think, for all stakeholders to build on past work. And then this last slide is simply, I've just added more of these reference materials to anybody who wants to dig out some of these old reports and do a deeper dive into the material that is presented, which is in much more detail than in the presentations provided here. And that was it.
Committee. More questions, reactions, discussion, observations? And by the way, Mr. Alanak, the 2008 report, was that the task force that was chaired by Lane Shetterly?
Yes, it is. Or yes, it was.
Anything from the committee? Well, this is a lot to think about. There's nothing else on our agenda today. Committee, any other final comments? Rep. Pham.
Thanks, Rep. Nathan. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to earlier just appreciate Mr. Alanak for that primer. Each time I get the primer, I get a deeper understanding of the complexities of property tax revenue. So I appreciate the history, especially the task force, the reminder of the findings in 2008. So I just wanted to express appreciation, no question.
Thank you, Rep. Pham. Mr. Alanak. I'm closing the informational meeting now. And do you have any final thoughts for the committee before we adjourn?
I do not, Madam Chair. Although I will add, well, I guess I said no, and then I'm adding something. The school funding piece that Rep. Marsh mentioned, and we'll add that to this ongoing list for any future discussions. And if any members have any areas where they'd like some additional information or a deeper dive, just reach out and let us know.
Thank you. And I made a note that one of our public hearings mentioned that we should expect amendments. That's House Bill 3295. There's no other business before us today. Thank you all. We're adjourned.